Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. In this program, we'll pay tribute to the late Christopher Columbus Kraft Jr. He passed away July 22nd, just 2 days after we marked the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11th moon landing. We'll do so by looking at the restoration of the room that he famously presided over in the late 1960s through early 70s as one of the primary members of the leadership team of NASA's moon program. The building at Johnson Space Center that houses all of the mission control rooms is named for him. When you think of mission control in Houston, you are literally thinking of the room that evolved from Chris Kraft's pioneering efforts to create a central place to control spaceflight missions. It's called the Mission Operations Control Room 2, or MOCR 2, and it was the place where history was made from Apollo 8's first trip around the moon at Christmas in 1968 to Neil Armstrong's one small step in 1969 and the Apollo 13 crisis in 1970. The room with the big screens in front showing the moonwalkers at Tranquility Base, with row after row of consoles of flight controllers monitoring displays indicating the status of everything from the spacecraft's electrical systems to the heart rates of the astronauts. And at the top row, in the very center, the man who designed all of this, Chris Kraft, would often be sitting and watching, there if needed. Dr. Kraft retired from NASA in 1982. MOCR 2 was retired 10 years later after the flight of STS-53, Space Shuttle Discovery. We'll also be hearing from one of the men who was a flight director in that room, Jerry Griffin. Kraft was not only Griffin's mentor and boss, but he was also a close personal friend, and we'll hear a bit about the man who literally created the concept of mission control. Over the years, MOCR 2 fell victim to the ravages of time and even a bit of neglect, along with being loved to death by NASA employees wanting to sit in those legendary seats. Our guest to talk about MOCR 2's restoration is Sandra Tetley. She's the NASA Historic Preservation Officer who oversaw the recently completed full restoration of MOCR 2 to its Apollo-era glory. It started in 2017 with an agreement between NASA, the Texas Historical Commission, and the National Park Service, and it was completed just this year in time for the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11. Sandra Tetley joined us from the Johnson Space Center in, where else, Houston. Sandra Tetley, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Well, we have so much to talk to, but before we get into restoration of the Mission Control Center, I'd like you to give us a little bit, because a lot of us have never been to Johnson Space Center. Can you give us a kind of a layout of where Mission Control is and the Christopher Kraft Mission Control Center, and then where the Apollo-era Mission Control Center is with relationship to that?
Sure. So Johnson Space Center is south of Houston, Texas, and we're in an area that is called Clear Lake. And as you come in the front gate, you'll drive toward some ponds that they had made. So it's sort of like a mall area. And building one is the very end building. And so it's a 9-story building. And building 30 is halfway down the mall, kind of to the left. It's one of our largest buildings. And it's very distinct, except for the administrative side. There are no windows in the building. You know, I think it's a Cat 3 hurricane proof because of the way the building and what needed to happen inside the building. It was named after Dr. Kraft, who was the very first flight controller and thought up the entire flight control and mission control process and design. So we had originally two different what was called mission control centers, and that consisted of the Mission Operations Control Room, which is the room that has the consoles and the large summary display screens. And it also had the adjacent viewing room, which was in the back and had the large windows that people could sit in and family and management could sit in and look into the MOCR. And then off to the side is the simulation control room. And further over is the recovery operations control room. And then in the very back behind the screens, because the screens were backlit with mirrors and projectors, that's called the Bat Cave. And that's a cool room. So we had duplicates, one on the second floor and on the third floor. They did the same thing. They changed missions, you know, depending on kind of what was going on. And so the Apollo Mission Control Center is on the third floor. We called it MOCR 2. And it gets, you know, we're very big on acronyms. So with the shuttle program, when the shuttle program came on, they changed from the term Mission Operations Control Room to Flight control room. So you'll know if anyone's talking about a Moker versus a Ficker, you know that the Moker is the Apollo program and Ficker is the shuttle program.
Ah, yeah.
You'll hear them used interchangeably at times because we also flew shuttle out of the Apollo Mission Control Center. So when someone talks about Ficker 2, then you know they're talking about the shuttle program.
So when was the last mission for Moker 2?
In 1992.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, it became kind of, I don't know what the expression would be, mothballed, but it was there. And when did it become a national historic landmark? Because it is that.
It actually, Building 30, the entire building is the National Historic Landmark. We flew the Gemini and the Apollo missions were flown within Moker 1 and Moker 2. And so the whole building is the National Historic Landmark. And what had happened is technology was changing so quickly during the 90s that they built an entire southern wing, which then they began to have, they built a brand new shuttle mission control room as well as an International Space Station mission control room. And so when those two rooms were built on this huge part of the building, and then they left Moker 2 or Ficker 2, and they basically abandoned it, as part of the mitigation for closing that room, which with the Historic Commission, they left the room as is. And so it was just left with the green consoles as they were. And then there were some bookcases left and some chairs, and that was it. And so they left it that way, but nothing was ever restored or done to the room after that. There were two other attempts to restore the room, but they never followed through, and nothing ever happened. And so it just sat there until we started on it, and it was in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, let's talk about that in a moment. But okay. Just to let our listeners know, Moker 2 is what you think of, you know, when you think of Houston, we've had a problem. And, you know, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. Those are the events that happened in that room. That is the most iconic, historic part of our space program, aside from Launch Complex 39A and the VAB, you know, Kennedy Space Center. It is the place where those things happened. So let's talk about this restoration effort. And before we go any further, I want to thank you on behalf of all America for doing this, because what you've done makes you, you know, a hero to me, because and your team. I know this is not something you did by yourself, but what you've done is just a wonderful thing. So let's talk about the state of that room when you started this project. There was a study done, I believe, 2013, to look into this. Tell us about the state of Moker 2 when this all started.
Okay, so when I became the historic preservation officer, we had two National Historic Landmarks, and I knew the importance of the Apollo Mission Control Center. My dad had worked at NASA, so I kind of grew up, you know, in the shadow of NASA and JSC, and I knew it was in just disrepair. It really was. When visitors came into the viewing room, they looked into the Moker, and the Moker was wide open. Anyone could walk into it, sit down at the consoles, you know, dial the phones, push the buttons, and people brought people in all the time. If you could get into Building 30, there were tours there all the time. That's where they would bring in the rock bands and the politicians and so forth. And, you know, you could walk around the consoles. They would have movie nights there, you know, including popcorn and drinks. And they would have our co-ops would come in and fill out their initial paperwork and drink their coffee at the consoles. So it was just open. Everyone knew how important it was, and it was a big deal to get on the floor and get on the Moker. So they understood the significance of it, but yet they did not honor it in the fashion that it should have been honored. So in 2013, I had applied for a grant with the National Park Service Heritage Partnership Program, and they give out money from time to time to National Historic Landmarks for projects or, you know, important things. So I had asked for $5,000 to develop some sort of visitor experience that people coming into the viewing room would experience the moon landing. And so they were very interested in it. And the assistant regional director and the partnerships program manager came down and talked to me. And I took them through mission control. And he, you know, they saw, now these are from the Park Service who manage National Historic Landmarks. So they saw how it was being treated and its disrepair. And they offered me $20,000 and matched the $20,000 to create the historic furnishings report. So that's what happened. And that became the basis of the restoration. So from that, that took about a year to write. And it examined everything that we would need to do to restore the Moker, the Bat Cave, the simulation control room, the recovery operations control room, and the viewing room. You know, NASA didn't have any money to do restoration like that. Our budgets were pretty bad, 10 years ago. And so it wasn't a priority. We knew it was a big project, so money was an issue. And there was just really no support for it, except for Mr. Kranz and Ed Findell were the first two that really started pushing for the restoration.
You're listening to Blue Dot. After a break, we'll return to our conversation with NASA Historical Preservation Officer Sandra Tetley as we look at the restoration of Mission Control, Moker 2. But first, let's hear from the man who succeeded Chris Kraft as director of the Johnson Space Center and former Apollo-era flight director Jerry Griffin, talking about his friend and mentor, Chris Kraft.
Well, I think he was probably, if not the key player, one of two or three key players that made it happen. And for sure, in terms of mission ops and how you control the flight and what it took to get it done, he was the pioneer that set us on the path that actually we're still using today. He was one heck of a leader. We wanted to follow him. I'm sure that in our history we've had a number of battlefield leaders that the troops were literally willing to give up their lives for. And that's kind of the way we felt with Chris. We'd do anything for him. We wanted him to succeed. And I think that's a sign of real leadership.
Could you perhaps share with us a story that kind of give us some insight into who he was?
Oh, sure. One of the strengths of NASA in that day was that decisions were pushed to the lowest level possible. That you put the decision making at the right level and where the expertise is, and you don't try to second guess them or even overrule them, which Kraft never did. And on Apollo 12, I was the flight director for the launch, and we took a couple of lightning strikes right after liftoff that really put us in a pickle. We finally got this spacecraft squared away and got on into orbit. And now we had to say, what are we going to do? Are we going on to the moon? Or are we going to come home? Because we'd been hit by lightning twice, not knowing exactly what it might have done. We checked out what we could, and everything looked okay, and we were in that final decision-making process whether to go for the moon or not, and Chris sat behind the flight director. He didn't talk to people on the loop, but he came down and put his hand on my right shoulder, and I turned around and looked at him, and he said, young man, and he called everybody young man, didn't make any difference how old they were. He said, young man, you don't have to go to the moon today. And I knew what he was saying is that it was my call, but don't feel like you're under any kind of pressure to go. It's your call to go or no go. And I just looked at him and nodded and said, okay. And about 10 minutes later, we made the decision to go on to the moon, and it worked. As a matter of fact, it was one of the cleanest flights we had after that point. And Chris and I have talked about that time. And he said, well, I meant it. He said, you know, it was your call. And he said, nobody else's. So here was an example that I saw of that style of leadership that I put you in this position. I trust you. I'm going to let you do the job. Go do it.
Jerry Griffin on the legendary Christopher Columbus Kraft Jr., the man who was the first to bear the famous moniker Flight. You're listening to Blue Dot. After a break, we'll return to our conversation with NASA Historical Preservation Officer Sandra Tetley as we look at the restoration of Mission Control. Stay with us.
let's return now to our interview with NASA Historical Preservation Officer Sandra Tetley as we talk about the restoration of Mission Control, also known as MOKR-2, in Houston. For our listeners, Gene Kranz is somebody they know because they've probably seen the movie Apollo 13. He was played by Ed Harris, the iconic white vest. You know, he was, you know, he was flight. He, you know, for a lot of people, he's the hero of Mission Control. And Ed Fendell, I remember him as the person that commanded the camera to track, like when the lunar module was lifting off the ascent stage, like on Apollo 17. He was the guy manning the camera to show that to us back on Earth. So these are two guys that have a totally vested interest in this. Tell us a little bit about Gene Kranz and Ed and the role that they played in this process.
Okay, so we're at the end when we got the draft historic furnishings report, and when I say draft, it was very complete, and the part that wasn't finished was that we wanted the stakeholders to come in and talk about the visitor experience and what the interpretation would be of a National Historic Landmark. And this is very standard for National Historic Landmarks and historic sites. So the Park Service held a workshop at JSC, and we invited flight operations, who are the, you know, that's the organization with the flight controllers in Building 30. We invited external relations, someone from Space Center Houston, which is our visitor center, the artifacts manager, the JSC historian, and then I invited Mr. Kranz and I believe Mr. Lunny and Mr. Griffin, Jerry Griffin. Mm-hmm. And those were flight directors. You know, they were the ones that kind of, you know, they're the heads, I guess, of each team. So none of them could come, but Mr. Kranz contacted me. He replied and he said, I would like to send Ed Fendell on my behalf. And I said, of course. So he gets there and so he's listening to all this. And so, funny story, he said to me, he said, do you know who I am? And I said, no, sir. You know, I don't. He said, exactly. And that was funny because, you know, I had invited Mr. Kranz and Mr. Lunny and Mr. Griffin. And so he was saying, you know, I don't know who you are, really. And so I went home and I looked him up and found out, you know, he is Captain Video for that reason, that he was able to capture the part that went back to the command module. He was able to capture that on video. So they called him Captain Video. So I told him that and he got a big kick out of that. But the second day of that workshop, he told me that the flight controllers were 100% behind me on the restoration. And they were. They fought for me and fought for the project from day one. And there's a lot of times when I couldn't really do anything because, you know, my job sort of was at stake. But they kept on and kept on and kept on and really pushed this through.
And let's talk about the funding for this, because it's my understanding that it's the city that JSC is in. Helped out with this. And there was a GoFundMe project, right?
Yes, there was. The Houston Chronicle had come out with an article in December of 2016, I believe. And it was saying that Apollo Mission Control was JSC's Gettysburg, that this was such an important place and it really needed to be preserved. And that was a big deal. I mean, it was big in Houston. And the Advisory Council for Historic Preservation Chair, Mr. Milford Wayne Donaldson, had come down a few months before when we hosted a National Trust tour. And so Mr. Donaldson, he's a presidential appointee and he's pretty powerful. So he contacted our NASA administrator in support of it, who then in turn contacted our Senate director and said, you know, y'all really need to try to do something on this. So a little team was formed. And after the Houston Chronicle article, the city of Webster stepped up and said, you know, we would like to donate $3.5 million toward this project. And so they donated it. Space Center Houston had kind of begun to talk about raising money for this. And so when Webster donated the money, $400,000 of it was a matching fund for a Kickstarter campaign. So Space Center Houston ran the Kickstarter campaign and raised $500,000. So together it was about $4 million that they were able to donate to us. And then JSC, we put in a little over $1 million. That was great. Without that initial donation, I think we'd still be putting pieces together.
Yeah. Let's talk about the actual restoration work. There had to be just an immense amount of research that you had to do and so many people to try to figure out how do you restore this room, this building, this place to exactly, because what you wanted to do, from my understanding, is to make it look like it did during the Apollo 11 mission. And my other understanding is you had great documentation from Apollo 15, and you were able to use that to really help restore it. So could you talk about the research that had to go into doing this, and then who you had restoring these consoles and things? Because wasn't it the Kansas Cosmosphere that did that?
Yes, they restored the consoles. So, yeah, what we did is we had the document, the historic furnishings report. And so, and while we were developing it through the workshop, it came to light that the flight controllers really wanted us to focus on the consoles as being in the configuration of Apollo 15, because that was the height of technological advancement for the Apollo program. After Apollo 15, the consoles did not change very much. And I'll explain the consoles real quick. They're a big shell, and then they are made up of these modules that are plugged into these different slots, and they can move everything around. You know, they can move the monitors, the buttons, the phones, everything can be moved around on these consoles. And they're all configured based on what that flight controller did, you know, booster or flight director, flight surgeon, you know, FAO, whatever their job was, their console was configured that way. So Apollo 15 was the height of the technological advancement. So we agreed to restore to Apollo 15. And also, that was the only manual that we had. The TR-155 is the documentation that documents how each of those consoles was configured at that time. And so we actually had a completely extant copy of that manual. And so that was what was used to restore the consoles. And they were completely taken apart and they were all cleaned. The shuttle components were removed. The Apollo components were put back in. What we didn't have, they actually created them to represent that one module. And then the CRTs were actually removed and we put in flat screens so that we could display imagery. And then the faceplates of those were recreated to look like the original. And also the buttons were lit up with LED backlit. So there was nothing destructive that happened to the consoles. It's all very non-destructive, which is the Secretary of the Interior standards for that. So the Cosmosphere literally took all the consoles. They took rows 1 and 2 first, and then they took rows 3 and 4, completely restored those. And in the meantime, the rest of the team was doing all the research necessary to determine what exactly the room looked like, the paint, the colors, the carpet, the wallpaper, you know, what we needed to do to the viewing room seats, which were original. The carpet in the viewing room was original. How to restore the phone booth, the ceiling, the lighting, and everything, every detail. Nothing was overlooked.
Yeah, and the fidelity that you have achieved here is just amazing. Tell us a little bit, like, let's start with the carpeting. Tell us about getting that carpeting right, because that's, you know, it sounds easy. Oh, let's just, you know, put carpeting. But that's not that simple.
Right. So we knew that between the Apollo and the shuttle program, we knew that it had been, the room had been re-wallpapered and re-carpeted. And that's kind of typical. When we change programs, they change the look of the room. So we knew that the wallpaper would have been changed and the carpet had been changed. And the current plans were that we were not going to change the wallpaper. But working with the carpet, we were trying to get the flight controllers, and they all said, well, I think it was gray, or I think it was this. And of course, all of the photographs we had, you know, they didn't take pictures of the carpet. So we were trying to piece together what the carpet looked like. And it's 28 by 28 computer floor tiles, which were hand cut, rolled carpet, hand cut. And so we were looking at even like things like, well, what would it take to do computer floor tiles or floor squares of carpet and so forth? And one day they were looking under a pneumatic tube station and they found the original carpet. Now, when they had recarpeted, the pneumatic tubes were installed and they were too difficult, you know, that you'd have to unhook all four pipes in the pneumatic tube and lift it up and recarpet it. So they just cut around and they just recarpeted around it. So we found the original carpet, which was wonderful. However, that carpet was a woven method, which is not used anymore, and it was cost a lot of money to be rewoven. But Mohawk Carpet took it, and using their tufted method, they were able to add an additional yarn, and they worked and worked on the pattern and then the color. And so what we have achieved is just a remarkable look of the original. So the same thing happened with the wall, or similar thing happened with the wallpaper. Someone had removed a fire extinguisher off the wall for some reason. We still don't know why, but the finishes guy said, look at this, that's the original wallpaper. So we took, he peeled it off, and we went back to the original drawings and found out who had created that wallpaper. And that company had been purchased. And so we went back to the company, and they found the roller in their warehouse and was able to pull it back out. And it had been retooled, meaning that it has a greater definition. It's a two-color method, but they were able to get our color and the pattern. And so we've replicated the wallpaper in the Mocher.
Yeah, that's just amazing. What about the ceiling?
So the ceiling, a similar story as well. We found original ceiling tile and only, you know, just a small piece, not even a whole piece, probably an eighth of a ceiling tile. And we pull it down, and they took it and they used it in a computer. They analyzed the whole pattern. So they went back to Armstrong Tile and they found the best base that was had the similar texture to it. And then using that computer analysis, they created a stamp made up of straight pins and small nails. And we hand stamped every single ceiling tile. And I got the most grief out of doing that because people are going, why would you waste time and money on that? You know, you can't even see the ceiling tile. It's like, but it's accurate. It's historically accurate. Yeah. So that's why we did it. So that was very cool too, to see, to hold the original tile next to the new tile. You cannot tell the difference.
And you know why I asked you about the ceiling tiles, right?
Because of the nicotine stain?
No, because they were Armstrong tiles.
Oh, that was good. Okay, yeah. I did not catch that. That's a good, good one.
You got to remember that for your next interview.
I will. I'll remember that.
Once again, here's Jerry Griffin reminiscing about his friend and mentor, Dr. Chris Kraft. He passed away on July 22nd, 2 days after the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission that he was so instrumental in.
Chris had an aura of invincibility that surrounded him. And that aura that he exuded without trying, it strengthened our confidence that we were doing things right because Chris is there and he says it's all right. And that's a quality of leadership that comes through in people like that. And man, it was palpable. I mean, you could feel it. There'll never be another one like him.
Yeah. Well, I've told people many times the last couple of weeks as we look back at Apollo 11 that, you know, people ask me all the time, did you want to be an astronaut when you were growing up? And I said, no, I had no desire to be an astronaut whatsoever. But I did want to wear a thin black tie and wear a short sleeve white shirt and sit at those consoles.
Yeah, we took some pictures during the 50th down there, and we all tried to find narrow black ties and short sleeve shirts. And I didn't have one that was white. But some of the guys found one, and some went to places like Walmart and Costco and places like that and found some fairly thin black ties or dark ties anyway. And it was kind of fun to see them.
Jerry Griffin, former Apollo flight director who was mentored throughout his career by his good friend, the late Dr. Chris Kraft. Let's take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Sandra Tetley about the restoration of Mocher 2, the historic mission control room in Houston.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Now let's return to our interview with NASA Historical Preservation Officer Sandra Tetley as we look at the restoration of MOKR-2 mission control for the Apollo era in Houston. For our listeners, you know, they're probably most familiar with mission control from the movie Apollo 13. And just to give us a mental picture of it, there's the glass-encased seating in the very back. It's like a theater where it has drop-down seating. And then you have the first top row of consoles. There's, I think, three of them. And Chris Kraft, the director of flight operations, would be in that middle console. And then you have the next row, and that's where Gene Kranz and Glenn Lunny and Jerry Griffin and those guys' flight would be. And then at the next row down, and I believe that's like where the surgeon would be, and the Capcom, which would be an astronaut, which was one of the astronauts talking to the astronauts. And then my favorite row, the very bottom one, was the trench. Tell us a little bit about the trench.
Yes, the trench. So the trench was named, and it's the very front row. It was named because they had a very colorful flight controller named John Llewellyn, who was an artillery man in the Korean War. And during the missions, when the pneumatic tubes, you know, the P tubes would be, the canisters would be coming out, they make a lot of racket. They come in and they, you know, slam against the little holder. And then if another one comes in, it'll slam and it'll often pop out that first canister. And they just kind of keep coming and they just keep popping out, and they'll be on the floor and they make a lot of noise and everything. And he said, "Oh my gosh," he said, "I feel like I'm back in the trenches of Korea with, you know, with all these shells coming at me." And so that's how it was named, the trench. And they're so famous that they even have matchbooks made out of, and that says the trench. And we actually have one on, someone donated one, and we have it on the console there.
Oh, that's way cool. And, you know, you mentioned pneumatic tubes, and for you know, a lot of people of a certain age right now, they have no idea what those are. But like before ATMs, you know, you would drive through the at the bank, and you would put your check and your deposit slip in this tube, this kind of plexiglass tube, put it in the pneumatic tube, and it would fire through to the banker, and then she would take it out and deposit it for you. That it's that kind of system where it's using air to run these documents around, right?
Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. I remember those. I hadn't thought about those in years. And then at the very front, of course, are the iconic screens where we saw the moonwalk and all of that going on. And then what's behind that?
Okay, so what's behind that is the Bat Cave. And the reason I call it the Bat Cave is because the ceiling, the floor, and all the walls are painted black, because that is where they had the projectors, which were the Idafor projectors, and then they had a different slide projector that was back there. And they used this same technology that we're using today, is where they project the image against a mirror, and then it is bounced back onto the screen. Also, the clocks that are at the very top, those were the mission clocks, and those were gone, and so we had to use projectors for that. So the mirrors remained. Four out of the five mirrors were still there. The main mirror had been removed because they changed the configuration of the Batcave, but we were able to get a new Mylar mirror put in, and so we've recreated everything that was on those screens and the mission clocks according to the five different parts of the Apollo mission, from descent and landing all the way through to recovery.
Oh, let's talk about that, because now, like, what's this going to be like for me as a visitor when I come to see this? And because I'm going to totally, you know, people are going to really want to see this now. Tell us about the visitor experience that you've planned.
Okay, so and it is really cool. I mean, we've had people just, you know, they cheer, they clap. It's very emotional. A lot of people have been brought to tears. And the team that we had put that together is just fantastic. So we're doing five different parts of the Apollo 11 mission, which is descent and landing. And then when they got out and Armstrong had his first step, and then when they got out and read the plaque that was on the limb, and then when President Nixon called them on the moon, which is a very moving conversation.
Neil and Buzz.
That's Neil and Buzz.
This has to be the most historic phone call ever made.
Yes. And it was really neat. And then recovery, when they were recovered. Mm. And what was cool about The original plans did not have that Nixon phone call in it. I don't even remember it. But we began to work with Stephen Slater, who is a Apollo film expert and archivist, and who also helped on the new movie Apollo 11. And then Ben Feist, who is an audio expert, and he's the one that took all of the channels of all the Apollo missions, the loops, communications loops, and set them all to GET. So at any point in a mission, you could hear everyone who was talking at that time. So okay. we worked with them and another gentleman named Tyler Strahl from Canada, who's an illustrator, and then our technical historic preservation expert, Adam Graves. And we all put together, we knew which parts of the mission that we wanted, but Stephen was the one that said, you know, this is so cool. You know, have you ever heard the Nixon phone call? And that phone call is so great because it really talked about, you know, we are all one in the world at this moment. And then we pray for your safe return, because in talking with the flight controllers, they were not sure they could even get them on the moon. And then once they were on the moon, they weren't even sure that they could get them back. So that's a very moving part. If you sort of, you know, if you understand that he's talking to them while on the moon, and we're not sure they'll ever come home.
Sure. And, you know, and a big point to make there is President Nixon had prepared a statement for if they were not able to get off the moon. He had that statement recorded, and, you know, and he was dreading that having to be, you know, anybody having to see that. So that's a really powerful thing to think about.
Yes, it is. And it is very moving. And it's really great. You know, Buzz salutes him, which is my favorite part when he salutes before they hang up. He actually salutes him twice. And then the recovery, which is really cool because that is the successful end of the mission. That is Kennedy's, his charge for the flight controllers. And they did get them back. So we play all of that. And everything you see has had to be recreated. Except for the imagery, the film that is, and it was actually not film, it was television broadcast that we show, which was exactly what the flight controllers were seeing at the time. Mm-hmm. We had to recreate all of that and sync it all and then sync it with the consoles. And we have a lighting control system so the lights go up and down, you know, for the experience. And it's super moving. It's really, really cool the way it's done. We had Gene Kranz, he narrates part of the mission. He's our narrator.
Oh, that's perfect. And I'll never forget that moment when it was successful and they had splashed down safely. All of those American flags that broke out in that control room when they had achieved what President Kennedy had set the goal for in 1961, and they had accomplished that mission. That was such a moment of national and international pride. It's amazing to think about how you're recreating that. That's wonderful. I want to ask you about the flight controllers. What has been their reaction? I imagine many of them have come back to see this. What kind of reactions are you getting from them?
Very emotional. The ones that have seen it as it's been, the ones that have been working with us, like Mr. Fendel and Mr. Kranz, you know, they've seen it kind of being built back up. And even with them, their reaction is very strong. We had Jack Knight come in, and he I don't remember what console he was at, but he was talking. He had seen it. He was just staring at it and looking at it. And he began to talk about it. He said, you know, when they called for 60 seconds and then when they called for 30 seconds, and he got choked up and, you know, had to stop a minute. And we've seen that happen with many of them. Will come in and they get very emotional and choked up. And some of them are very nice. You know, they say, oh, you know, look at this. And how about this? And they're very excited. And my favorite story is Mr. Kranz was going to be interviewed by ABC News a couple weeks ago. And they were up kind of in the very top row up in an area that's kind of opened by the public affairs console, and they had set up and they were going to interview him. And he came in the door, and it had been raining in Houston, so he had an overcoat on, and he was taking it off as he was walking up the stairs. He reached over on our coat rack. He took a hanger off the coat rack, hung up his coat, and hung it right up, and kept walking up just like it was another day at the office. And we just looked at each other ourselves, and we said, you know, if he feels that comfortable, then we have done our job.
that gave me goosebumps just to hear about that, because that's amazing. And when you said, you know, the 60 seconds and 30 seconds, what he's talking about is when Eagle was descending to land, they had 60 seconds of fuel left before they had to abort. And then 30 seconds, I believe they got down to 17 seconds of fuel left. And, you know, everybody was on pins and needles in that Moker 2. And so Charlie Duke, the Capcom, famously says, "We copy you down, Eagle. We got a bunch of people about to turn blue here. Thanks a lot." You know, he was so flustered at that point, he called it Tranquility Base.
Yeah, that's right. And what's really cool in our visitor experience, we have added on the loops and the voices that were happening at the time, because, you know, there's a contact light that came on because there was sort of a probe that was coming down. And then, and so you hear these things, these gasps and, you know, like touchdown, we see contact, the contact lights and that kind of thing. And you could hear the stress in their voice. And then when they say, you know, we've had shutdown, and then that's when Charlie Duke says, "We copy you down, Eagle." And then, you know, it's just so, you know, we're trying to capture that anxiety and that stress and that utter, thrill that they had when they actually got them to the moon, and it was cool. That's a famous part. It's very moving.
Speaking of moving parts, and I mentioned this earlier, and I wanted to ask you about this, and I kind of forgot because this is just so fascinating to me. For the movie Apollo 13, was there any kind of outreach to them, because they recreated that mission control room so beautifully for that film? Was there any kind of role that they played?
We did. Actually, our technical expert, Dr. Adam Graves, he did reach out to the guys at Apollo 13, the set director, I believe. And he said, you know, y'all need to talk to the Cosmosphere, because they're the ones that helped us with the consoles. So between Adam and I had been referred to the Cosmosphere through Mr. Kranz, I believe. And so, you know, they were both focused back on the Cosmosphere. The Cosmosphere actually has the green consoles from Moker 1. So they're very familiar with the consoles, and there's a special place for the consoles and people that deal with them. And so they had all the expertise that we wanted and needed. And, but yeah, the Apollo 13 people, they, you know, pointed us directly to Cosmosphere.
And as Gene Kranz himself has pointed out, you know, that was probably the flight controller's finest moment, was the Apollo 13 mission. And as I recall, was it the astronauts that put a mirror up in Moker 2 for the flight controllers? It's like, you know, look in this, you're the real heroes. Is that right? Is that there? Do you have the mirror?
It is there. And there's an interesting story about that. So when we first got it, or when it was first presented to the flight controllers, it was actually on a wall on the north part of the Moker, next to the simulation control room. And then they had moved it over, you know, to put it, it was above the water fountain. And the astronaut said, "We want it above the water fountain, because when you go there and you look in the mirror, you see a hero." So it's been over the water fountain. So when we were doing the restoration, over that water fountain was a big cork board that they had put up there. And so, you know, we were going for historic accuracy. And so we had the cork board going there, and then we were putting the Apollo 13 mirror back in its original location when they had first hung it in the Moker. And I think that's why it wasn't originally hung over the water fountain, is because of this big, huge cork board. So when we had done that, that was the plans. The plan had been approved. And one day we knew that Jim Lovell was coming in to visit. So Adam Graves, what a fantastic idea. He got the mirror out of storage, because at this time we didn't have consoles in when Mr. Lovell came in.
The commander of Apollo 13.
Right, the commander of Apollo 13. He came in, and Adam had taken the mirror out of storage, and he had leaned it against the front wall right underneath the large summary display screen. Well, when Mr. Lovell came around the corner, he went down the long north hall, and then he kind of comes around the corner the main floor of the Moker. He was pointing over at the water fountain going, you know, the mirror that used to be right there. And so we just go, it's right there. And so it was such a great thing. He was so excited to get the mirror, and he picked it up, and they had a group photograph. He was there with his daughter and grandchildren, and we took a photograph of that. So we were just like looking at ourselves going, it's got to go back over the water fountain. So we changed the plan and we put it back. It is still now and forever will be over the water fountain. I'm glad we did, because Fred Hayes came in as well, and he did the exact same thing. You know, where's the mirror? And we said, we haven't put it up yet because we can't, it's not secure yet. Mm-hmm. And so, but we put it back there.
Gosh. Yeah, that's an amazing story. Let's talk, you know, we've got the consoles all restored. You got your carpeting restored. You got ceiling tiles, courtesy of Armstrong, of course. Got a little commercial there for you. And everything's done now. But the part that I just thought was really cool, looking at some of the photographs I've seen, are the ashtrays and the coffee cups and the notebooks. Tell us a bit about that.
Right. So we had one lady, Delaney Harris Finch, and she was in charge of all the artifacts in the room, all the furnishings and artifacts. So she's been working on this for over a year, getting everything. And it's not that we went out and just bought all this 1960s stuff and stuck it on the consoles. We literally, and she did, went through copious amounts of photographs and film and, you know, all kind of imagery to get everything that's sitting on a console was sitting there during the Apollo 11 mission. Every cup, ashtray, lighter, cigar, pipe, you know, whatever it was, she found all of that. And we also did like a big scavenger hunt at JSC on site. We put the word out that if you have anything from the Apollo era, any gray chair or a hangers or coat racks or desks or cabinets, hole punch, you know, anything of that era, you know, put it in these big collection boxes. And so that's where we got almost all of the big blacks or the black Skillcraft binders and the hole punches and all that kind of stuff we got from site, all the chairs that are in there and the bookcases and the coat racks. And then she went on eBay and mainly eBay, and then thrift stores and antique shops and everything for everything. And she was able to hone in on these coffee cups. And she even got the rocket coffee maker that's sitting in the back on the very back corner of the top row.
Oh, yeah.
She found the creamer that still had creamer in it. It had been unopened. It's great. We have everything is authentic and just like it looks in the pictures. And that was really part of the most fun that we had is, putting all those things, you know, out on the consoles and then when the flight controllers come in, you know, it brings back a lot of memories of, even, you know, what they smoke and we've had flight controllers go, well, you know, I never smoked that. And we have film of them, you know, smoking and things like that. We had one flight controller said, I would never put my coffee cup on top of the console. That's not my coffee cup. And yet the visitor experience, the old imagery that we show, he's actually smiling, looking over that orange coffee cup. So we do a trust but verify with them.
Yeah.
It's been a long time, but that was really the most fun, getting the documents put out and the, you know, everything that they use, the maps, the documents and all that. That was really a fun part of you're putting the icing on the cake at that point.
Yeah. Cause it looks like, you know, it just looks like they walked out of the room for a break and they could come walking back in at any moment.
Yes, that's exactly what we wanted it, that they just got up and walked out.
Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us today and sharing your expertise about this just amazing project of restoring mission control to its Apollo era, because I remember where I was, and I was in, like a lot of Americans my age, in our living room, watching this all unfold on television, and I'll never forget that moment. And so thanks again, Sandra. I really appreciate you spending the time with us and this incredible effort on behalf of your team. Congratulations and thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I can't wait for you to see it.
Yeah, I would love, you know, it's difficult for me, but I hope to get to see it someday.
Good. I do too. Thank you again.
thanks to our guest, Sandra Tetley, Historical Preservation Officer for NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, the home of Mission Control past, present, and hopefully future. And special thanks to our friend Jerry Griffin for sharing memories of his friend, the late Dr. Chris Kraft. The loss of Dr. Kraft was a heavy blow to me, but I know it was much harder on the friends that he had mentored, like Jerry Griffin, along with his fellow flight directors Gene Kranz and Glenn Lunny. Perhaps it was Lunny who expressed it best in an oral history from NASA in 1998 when he reflected on the man known as Flight. He instilled a sense of what was right, what was wrong, and what you had to do, how good you had to be, and those standards that he kind of inbred into everybody by his own example and by what he did with us continue today. The Control Center today is a reflection of Chris Kraft. So if you ever get a chance to visit Moker 2 in Houston, and I hope you do, be sure and give thanks to the man who was most responsible for it, Chris Kraft. His name's on the side of the building, after all. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast at the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot. And farewell, Dr. Kraft. You are go, Flight.